I'll give you a heads up here. This next conversation is going to touch on some hard issues, suicide and death, because those things are all in a day's work for a paramedic, along with asthma, heart attacks, domestic violence, births and more. But while we rely on them to take care of others, how do paramedics take care of themselves? In his new book, The Gap, author and paramedic Benjamin Gilmore shines a light onto what happens after a 000 call is made. Benjamin, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you, Hilary, for having me.
Now, let's go way back to when you were making decisions about what you wanted to do with your life. Why did you decide to train as a paramedic?
It was something I think that had been in my mind ever since I was a kid, running to the window to watch ambulances go up the street outside our place. We lived in Lane Cove, not far from the ambulance station down there. And I was that kid at the window watching that ambulance scream past. But I think what really spurred me on to wanting that career was an incident that happened when I was 16. I was allowed to go into the city, probably for the first time, with a couple of my friends on our own. And we were on Town Hall railway station when we came across two unconscious people lying on the platform. I distinctly remember these this pair of paramedics turning up and injecting these two people with the substance I later realised was Narcan, and these patients had had heroin overdoses. And watching as these two individuals came back to life and were revived very quickly by these paramedics. I just thought it was fabulous, and I thought that was something I could really see myself doing.
And you write about, the intensity and the drama and the having to be cool, calm and collected. You've seen heroin overdoses yourself as well as births and other traumatic things. Why did you want to revisit all these moments by writing about them?
Well, the book, The Gap, is a story of just one particular summer of 2007-2008, a remarkable and very difficult period of time for me and many of my colleagues in the eastern suburbs of Sydney. And yeah, absolutely, it was, I suppose, the first draft of the book, which was written about a year after the events of the book, was therapeutic, I guess. But in the edit, you're kind of reliving that again and again. I have my editors at Penguin to thank for that. You do go over it a lot. You go over the manuscript a lot before publication. And that was draining. And it was, I guess, counter to my survival instincts, because your brain naturally packs away these things. Certainly, as paramedics, we have a lot of scars. We have we bear witness to a lot of trauma and death on a regular basis, and so we do pack those things away, and that allows us to keep going. So opening those kind of old wounds was difficult in the process, but I think that the level of those scars, they demonstrate your experience. And I feel that if you have someone that has been blessed with this kind of privileged experience of being around trauma and death and people struggling through life, that that's important, an important opportunity to share what you've learned. And so that was a step that I was willing to take.
And you talk about the complexity of the emotions and experiences you can have when you're with someone in that, a patient in that really high stake moment when you're trying to save their life. What kind of conversations have you had with people in those times?
Well, I mean, they range because the reasons people are on the edge vary so much, and so the conversations range from patients telling about their relationships that have kind of broken up, from financial difficulties, from homelessness to struggles with gambling and alcohol, and of course, very commonly, people with chronic, long-term mental illness who are at a very high risk of taking their own lives. And but in those critical moments when somebody is on the edge, it's almost beyond a counselling session in that moment. It's the objective is more about safety, bringing them to safety, and restoring even the faintest glimmer of hope in that moment, that can pull an individual back into life and the hope that life can somehow get better for them. That's the primary objective in those critical moments.
You also talk about the paramedics being burdened by the expectation of miracles. Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, I think the hero image of the paramedic has not done us a very good service over time. And I think it's an expectation that is very difficult to live up to. For me, at least, I have found that those expectations that we work miracles is something that is very hard to live up to when you're dealing with fate. You're dealing with situations. I mean, an example being cardiac arrest, which I talk about in the book. My struggles with understanding why, despite all our best efforts. And all my best efforts over a period of 10 years, that I had not had anyone walk out of hospital during that period after being revived. Now, people are resuscitated. They do come out and walk out of hospital. It happens, but it's certainly not as frequent as people think it is. And so you're working against these odds, and yet the public expectation and the expectation we put on ourselves, that pressure. Can end up leaving us feeling like failures, and that level of guilt that builds. It's a cumulative thing, and I think it's not healthy for us.
When you've talked about in the book compassion competition, that the patient has to get most of your mental and emotional resources. So when you clock off, how do you take care of yourself? What do you do to preserve your mental well-being?
Well, I think this competition between, I think it's more that we live in the shadow of other people's arguably deeper trauma, and so we don't allow ourselves to feel sadness and to reach out for help when we're struggling with mental health issues. You know, it's very difficult. When you're faced with a mother who has lost a child, for example, in an accident, to have any room for your own self-pity. Even if you happen to have a child yourself of a similar age and you know, it kind of feels indulgent somehow to cry about that. So I find that the problem with that becomes that you start to feel you don't have any business to feel sorry for yourself and allow yourself to grieve and to process some of these experiences,
and so they build up and build up. What you've learnt some really hard lessons over the years about the need to do that. What do you do these days to wind down?
Well, everyone has their own ways of dealing with the impact of the work, and for me, I think it's important to make fun, to make room for fun in your life, in your private life. I drive to the beach in my vintage car with my family in fancy dress and play Latin tunes on the radio and, you know, like to kind of live in a kind of wild and fun and a silly way and not take life too seriously outside of work. When you're in the realm of such heavy duty kind of business at work, I think you need a bit of lightness. And my outlet is also on the creative side of things with writing and filmmaking. That's really important.
We're talking to Benjamin Gilmore, who is a writer and filmmaker. His book is called The Gap, a memoir of a very intense summer over 2007-2008. And Benjamin, there's quite a bit of humour throughout the book too. You were drenched in amniotic fluid, delivering a baby suddenly, for example. And there's one young guy who went to some pretty extreme lengths just to get a kiss.
Yes, the asthmatic kid. Well, the alleged asthmatic. So in that case, a teenager who had fallen for a girl who didn't feel the same way. It was a case of unrequited love. He faked an asthma attack and stopped breathing and pretended to stop breathing, and so she gave him mouth to mouth. Of course, it went a little bit too far because one of the friends called an ambulance and we got there and we could recognise straight away that it wasn't what everyone thought it was. And but this is an example of the humour that exists in the job and the way the job also makes us laugh all the time, and how important that is in dealing with the heavier side of the job.
I must say, it was very kind of you not to give him away. You dragged him off into a little room and said, look, this is not okay. And I hope she didn't fall for it either. That's a terrible thing to do to someone, isn't it?
Well, you kind of got to give the guy credit for a creative way of, having a bit of fun. And, but also it's, it's kind of unfair to kind of expose people like that and have them lose face in that kind of environment.
I don't know. I think it's pretty unfair to kiss someone who's got no idea what's going on when they think they're doing you a favour. Benjamin, how has your attitude to death changed over the years? I mean, you're exposed to it a lot, but you've obviously found a way to go on, and you've got a family of your own. How do you deal with that idea?
Well, it has been a struggle over time, trying to, balance the idea of fighting against death and accepting death. And I'm not talking about suicide, where you have a real chance of prevention. I'm talking about cases where there really isn't much hope in cardiac arrest in elderly people, for example. At what point do we stop fighting death and accept it? And there's a real denial of death, I find, among many people out there. Even, relatives of some of my patients in their 90s, not being able to grasp how the death of their loved one has happened, even though it's, to us there is no surprise in someone in their mid to late 90s passing away. So, death is natural. And in many cases, I'm not talking about people injured in car accidents or trauma, physical trauma, but I find that sometimes, it's hard for us to also accept that there's this kind of pressure on us to fight against the odds. And that expectation, again, plays into what we were talking about earlier about the expectations we put on ourselves that we can't often meet, and it ends up affecting our own mental health.
Yep, it's a good idea to get through past that idea that some miracle will save us from death one day, isn't it? Benjamin Gilmore, thanks so much for letting us dip a toe in with you to that intense summer from your memoir, The Gap. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Hilary.
Benjamin Gilmore here on Life Matters on RN. He's a paramedic still. And if any part of this conversation has been distressing for you, you can speak to someone at any time at Lifeline. It's a 24-hour service. And the number's 13 11 14. That number again, 13 11 14. I'm Hilary Harper. This is Life Matters on RN.